TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Alexander Coburn, The Israeli Lobby and the Fate of Palestine. On May 2, 2002, barely 2 weeks after what has become widely described in the international press as a massacre in the Palestinian refugee camp at Jenin, the U.S. Congress took an extraordinary vote. It was a vote supporting Israel's offensive into the West Bank and a cover for their actions in Jenin. Only 2 senators and 21 representatives voted against the resolution. Cynthia McKinney from Georgia and Earl Hilliard from Alabama were among those 21, and before long, both of them lost their seats in Congress. Alexander Coburn is an investigative journalist and author. He was born and raised in Ireland and has lived and worked in the U.S. since 1973. He writes a biweekly column for The Nation called Beat the Devil and a syndicated newspaper column which has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, and others. Coburn is also the co-editor with Jeffrey St. Clair of the muckraking newsletter Counterpunch. Alexander Coburn spoke on the Israeli lobby and the fate of Palestine in San Francisco on September 29th, 2002.
I'm going to evoke the political atmosphere to a certain extent and then go into there to what the purchase of power in the political culture here of extremist policies in Israel really is, and remind you initially of a couple of real pointers we had this year. The first was a vote in the U.S. Congress a few months ago, which was essentially calling on Congress to utter wholehearted support for the policies of Sharon. And I don't know how many of you remember how many politicians felt able to vote no. 21 U.S. representatives and precisely 2 U.S. senators. And the bold tribunes of the people in the Senate were Bobby Byrd of West Virginia, who now is becoming the conscience of our country. He has only death to fear. The people of West Virginia aren't going to turn him out. So he felt okay to do it, and the other bold tribune of the people was Senator Ernest Hollings of South Carolina. The only 2. And 21 U.S. representatives, not including some people whom I admire very often as politicians, just felt they couldn't do it, like Dennis Kucinich of Ohio. I've absolutely no doubt that Dennis Kucinich, whom I've known for a very long time, is absolutely clear on the injustices being done to the people of Palestine, Palestinian people. He also had pretty, since he's a prudent politician, a pretty good idea of what would happen to him in Cleveland if he voted yes as opposed to present. We're talking to people who took a look at the kind of hot water they'd get themselves into and didn't dare take the risk, even though it was ever been an obvious moment for a person of conscience to vote no to the policies of Israel, no to U.S. support. It was them. That was an expression of clout, raw and harsh. And then I'll just remind you quickly of what happened to Hilliard in Alabama, first black congressman since Reconstruction, I think a 5, maybe even longer term incumbent, who went down because American Jewish money just poured into the campaign coffers of his opponent in the Democratic primary. This is all in the Democratic primaries. Hot on the heels of Hilliard came, of course, the onslaught on Cynthia McKinney, one of the most outspoken and terrific representatives we'd had, a 5-term rep from the 4th District of Georgia, who had triumphed over a very, very pernicious redistricting 2 years ago, which brought into her district a lot of white Republicans. And she became the focus, once again, of a ferocious assault. And it played out in a pretty familiar way. McKinney, seeing what was happening, seeing a torrent of money from American Jewish groups going into the campaign treasury of her opponent, Majette, Denise Majette, a former judge whose last known political preference in the 2000 race was to endorse Alan Keyes. Now, I don't know if you're all political scientists here. You remember who Alan Keyes was, the very eloquent black presidential candidate whose main plank was against choice. That was his main plank. Now, you would have thought, this is an example of how these things play out, that if someone seen as a progressive congressperson, five-term incumbent, was suddenly under attack from a person whose previous political passion had been a Republican anti-choice, this would have brought, you might have considered, every liberal group, every woman's group in the country rallying and rushing to the help of McKinney. Didn't happen. Did not happen. Some people rallied, to their credit, but a lot of people in the Democratic Party sat on their hands. And then in the middle of all this, when of course she is getting the support of Arab Americans, the Atlanta Constitution rushes to look at her funding list and says she is being financed by terror. Pretty simple. In fact, the Atlanta Constitution inspected the lists of who was giving her money and said, quote, about one-fourth of the individuals who have contributed to McKinney's campaigns over the past 5 years have names that appear to be Arab American or Muslim, according to an informal study of Federal Election Commission records by the Journal Constitution. Now, can you imagine those reporters writing it the other way around? About one-fourth of the names appear to be of Jewish origin. Can you imagine that appearing? No, of course you can't. So, McKinney went down. And the moral of that was again an exhibition of raw clout. You vote in a way that is perceived by Jewish American groups as being anti-Israel, meaning anti the most extreme policies of Israel, and you'll get it. You'll get it in the net. This is a warning to you. And those warnings have been issued down the years, whether it's Senator Percy or the pretty few other politicians who have been courageous enough to stand up. And it's also a message to the Black Congressional Caucus. And I wrote a piece somewhere, The Nation, I think, and I said, there won't be direct expressions of remorse or regret that McKinney has effectively been turned out by someone who's a Republican and will probably go back to the Republican Party in a couple of years. They'll say that this provokes fears of a rise of black anti-Semitism. That's the way it'll be played. It's already being played like that. And they say that, you know, although this is a testing of the ancient coalition between Jewish and black groups within the Democratic Party. It was nothing of the sort, of course. It was saying to the Black Congressional Caucus, you do anything we don't like and you're going to get it. And the leadership of the Democratic Party is not going to lift a finger. Not only does the public support go, the money go into Majette, who finally outspent McKinney, I think, by pretty much twice. Now, McKinney actually, of course, got slightly more black votes than she did in the year 2000. What made the difference was really the ferocious campaign among the white voters by the Jewish American groups and by the Republicans. So that was cautionary parable number two. Now, come to a moment to the question of the U.S. media. And every now and again, people raise a question, and they say, do the Jews control the media? You know, and everyone says, oh, of course they don't control the media. And if you get stuck in that box, you know, you either have to patiently go through every newspaper in the United States, and sure, there are a lot of newspapers that aren't run by Jewish families, or they're run by vast corporations. You can't possibly tell. It's not really the way to go at it, because also you get painted as a nut. The question is, just on observable fact, without having to go through the genealogies of every single person who owns what passes for a free press in the United States, just look at what you read. It's a quicker way of doing it. And the truth of the matter is that, again, you want to be careful here. Every now and again, good pieces appear. Someone who's come back, some member of a church group, someone who's been on a delegation. There's plenty of decent writing in a lot of American papers by ordinary folks. We're talking really about dominant media here. Now, when you go to what you might call the commanding heights of the media, then, of course, it's a very different story. Now you're talking about a pretty small number of papers, and of course, if you're talking about television, and you're talking about AM radio in terms of real influence. And there, of course, you can go through, and that outfit FAIR, for accuracy, fairness and accuracy in reporting, and there are other groups do these painstaking analyses, which are always worth having. They tot up unimaginably horrible tasks to have to do. You know, how many articles are pro on the op-ed pages of Britain basically saying the Palestinians should be run into the sea, and how many put in a decent word for justice? And, of course, it comes out 85% to 15%. And then you can do the analysis of who's doing the reporting. You see how many newspapers have actually, you know, run objective and fair descriptions of the negotiating process. What does the peace process really mean? How many newspapers just parrot the word peace process? And you've got once again come to a dismal conclusion. And the situation, of course, when you get to TV is even worse, far worse, actually, far worse. I mean, there was a famous description by an FCC commissioner called Newt Minow, who referred to US TV as a vast wasteland. Half the time it's sheer ignorance, and the other half of the time it's maleficence. It's a mixture of the two. People say, people tell them what to say? Most of the time they don't need to be told. There's a famous rhyme. You cannot hope to bribe or twist, thank God, the British journalist. But seeing what the guy will do unpaid, there's no occasion to. Written by Hilaire Belloc, well-known English wit. We had a very interesting analysis, which we ran in Counterpunch by, it's actually up on the web, and I'd encourage people who can do it, by Kathleen Christensen, a former CIA analyst, and her husband, Bill. They're very good people. She did a long piece on 242, a whole history of 242 and what happened to, you know, the original resolution, how gradually down the years, administration after administration, Democratic, Republican, didn't make any difference. Gradually, the original intention of 242, which was to lay out, you know, the path towards Palestinian self-determination in a sovereign nation, was gradually turned upside down and destroyed, and ultimately ended up in the Barak offer, which was three mini Bantustans detached from each other, separated by freeways. I used to say it would be better for the Palestinians if you offered them Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. There's more contiguous territory there than there was in the Barak offer. You know? The reporter for the New York Times, who I've got no admiration for, Debbie Sontag, actually wrote, and Christensen quoted it, not bad reporting, saying, wait a minute here. It's not as simple as just saying the best effort the Palestinians ever got. Let's look at what really happened. Let's see what really happened at Camp David. And she made, I won't say it was a brilliant attempt, but not a bad effort to disinter the truth. That piece by the New York Times reporter was directly confuted by the New York Times editorials, which said exactly the reverse, and by, of course, the man now most laden with honor and glory, I think in the history of American journalism, Thomas Friedman. Nine receipt of not one, not two, but three Pulitzer Prizes. And really, the death knell of the Pulitzer industry is like incarnate in Mr. Friedman. And once you've got the tone being set by the New York Times and the Washington Post, and don't forget the fanatical Christians of the Wall Street Journal, from originally a Midwestern paper, you've got a pretty formidable consensus. No rational discussion of the Middle East whatsoever. No rational discussion of what's actually going on. No way of looking at what Israel's really been up to. No way of saying how Palestinians have been systematically betrayed down the years. There exists in the formation and fashioning of policy in D.C., there are an endless structure and network of think tanks, of lobbying outfits, of non-profits, who have a real role in conditioning the tone and set of a political culture. For example, in the 70s, when the onslaught on regulation was really getting underway, an onslaught which ultimately produced the corporate culture, which has produced the greatest crime wave in the history of capitalism, the crime wave of the middle to late 90s, which have seen the flower and cream of corporate America misrepresenting its balance sheets by up to, WorldCom, $9 billion. That's a lot of noughts to get wrong. The groundwork for all that was laid originally by corporate-backed foundations and by think tanks back in the 70s, the Manhattan Institute. One seminar after another, the role of risk, meaning get rid of regulation. Glass-Steagall, let's make banks capable of doing everything. And these, if you keep at it long enough, you handle out enough fellowships, if you get enough Congress people there, it's going to have an effect on the way policy is discussed. Now, the same is, of course, true in Washington today, in an enormous number of institutes. It's hard to keep them all straight in their head, and I can't. They give themselves wonderful names, scholar-in-residence. For some scallywag who's been sitting there for about 5 minutes. Can barely hold a book the right way up. And these are the people you'll see then on CNN. They're there straining at the leash. So we have seen really in over many, many years this systematic degradation of discussion at the semi-official level of what a reasonable foreign policy would be as regards the Middle East in Washington political culture. And that has gone hand in hand, really, with the decline of the sort of official level of our political culture. I'm talking now about the collapse of any real liberal culture, political culture. The rise of neoliberalism, which really also began in the late 70s. And on the Republican side, pretty much the extinction of the moderate Republican wing and the conversion of most of the Republican Party into a crowd of mad dogs, which we now see flowering finally in the dream. The Republicans now see it's the Judeo-Christian Alliance. They both, of course, have kindred up to a point, expectations and dreams of the Holy Land. For the Christians, they have to get back in there, convert the Jews, and then in the great uprising, the water spout, after they've recaptured the Holy Land, they'll be on top. Of course, the Jews have a slightly different vision in which the Christians are not quite so privileged, but at the moment, call it a tactical alliance, with the end game to be discussed at some later point. maybe as the water spout goes up. I don't know what point you can say. By the way, we've got slightly different plans than you guys. But the one thing they're united in common is that the people who do not have a purchase on Judea and Samaria to take the heartlands of Holy Writ are the people entitled to have a free nation, viz. The Palestinians. So now we get to the question of government policy. Governments usually at some point have a rational foreign policy. What would be a rational foreign policy in the wake of 9/11? It's not hard to conceive of it. You want to reduce terror, you reduce the conditions of terror. It doesn't have to be exactly the vision of society that most of the people in this room might to go for, but you know, all right, if the world is getting to be a dangerous place and people are flying planes into our buildings and so on and so forth, reduce the conditions of producing that kind of anger and fury by, let's say, a world program of economic adjustment to raise up the level of poor people. A rational policy. Not a socialist policy, it's a policy of common sense. By altering the balance of resources from the vast wealth of the United States and of the larger capitalist countries of Europe. Introduce a measure of justice into the Middle East. Restore some sense of equity to international diplomacy. But of course, you haven't got any of those things. And the response has been insane. Absolutely insane, and will probably produce, you know, another round of onslaughts with another round of repression. And we, I think, again, have the least qualified, probably, executive I can remember. In the sense of a guy, Bush, I think actually, that his theological outlook and of those around him, including some of his speechwriters who genuinely believe, you know, that the world was like fixed up on sort of divine contract in 4000 BC or whenever it was. Sorry that some of my theological observations are a little vague, but I think he is a fanatic. I think Rumsfeld is a fanatic. Rumsfeld's one of the most dangerous people who have been in government for many, many years. Absolutely. And you see Rumsfeld the other day, you remember, confuting, now, official U.S. policy and actual U.S. policy, of course, don't always mesh at the level of practice. Official U.S. policy has been to condemn the settlements, for example. Actual U.S. policy has been to condone them, pay for them, assist in them, cover them up with diplomatic maneuver. But there has been official U.S. policy, which not so long ago, Rumsfeld simply overthrew. I don't know how many of you remember it. He just said it in a press conference. I said, yeah, they won it fair and square. It's theirs. What a humiliation for Secretary of State Powell. So you have probably, and I think this would be, if you took a poll of leaders in countries around the world, probably the most sort of ignorant and frightening U.S. administration in a very, very long time. We're governed by fanatics. We are dominated in terms of political culture by an incredibly well-organized lobby. I really forbore for going through all the ways the lobby works, because I think you all know it. How do lobbies work? They organize, they go out, they spend money, they intimidate, they coerce, they frighten Congress people, they spread more money around, they capture the Democratic Party, and they capture the Republican Party. There's the lobby for you. In terms of operation. And the media are by and large cowed and self-serving. And there are outposts of resistance. To a certain extent in the churches, to a very, very minor, I think, extent in the labor movement. And to a certain extent in the academies, in the peace movement and the internationalist movement. And of course in the resistance that comes from the Arab American communities themselves. And I can remember living in New York in the 70s. When even to use the word Palestinian and Palestine was thought to be an outrage. Because Golda Meir, you might recall it, said there was no such thing as a Palestinian. And that was the political culture then. That isn't the political culture now. The other day, some guy called me an anti-Semite. And I said, so I said, you know. I mean, which I said, you know, the more disgusting things Sharon and his people do, the more you get called an anti-Semite. So I think there is a level of hysteria that comes from a level of feeling we are really endorsing horrible deeds, to the extent that the apologists here among the American Jewish community, they're apologizing for horrible savagery. But now when you get people right after Jenin and they say, well, it wasn't 600, you know, it was only like 200. They only crushed 3 children to death, not 10 like you said. And you get that kind of chopping and pinching around. There's a profound disquiet. There's a profound unease. I mean, people aren't totally morally stupid all the time. And I think a lot of the frenzy and hysteria now is because they know that Israeli policy is, and the policy towards Palestinians, is an abomination. So that is a context in which work can be done and what must be done. So a final thought. One can discuss the lobby. One can say the lobby. But lobbies, it wasn't so long ago that the lobby for Taiwan was regarded as the most terrifying lobby in the history of American political science. Historical circumstances change. People organize. Information gets out. The balance of world power changes. Things change. Nothing is on a lock. And so, in that context, you can certainly assess the strength of the foe, understand the strength of the foe, but not be intimidated by the strength of the foe. Thank you.
That was Alexander Coburn, one of the foremost reporters and commentators on the left. He writes for The Nation, the Los Angeles Times, and other papers, and is the author of many books, among them Corruptions of Empire and The Golden Age is in Us. His most recent book with Jeffrey Sinclair is 5 Days That Shook the World, Seattle and Beyond. Coburn and Sinclair are co-editors of the muckraking newsletter Counterpunch. That website, www.counterpunch.org, now has a world audience in the millions. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Alexander Coburn on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this talk by Alexander Coburn by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.